Hello educators, and I'm glad you can join me for Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Inside Education is your weekly guide to the world of education from an Irish perspective. My name is Sean Delaney and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes. You can listen to or download over 250 editions of previous programmes on seandelaney.com/podcasts. This week, I speak to a faculty member of Harvard Graduate School of Education, who was a former high school teacher and who is interested in the work of teachers, in school reform, in trade unions, and in leadership in schools. Susan Moore-Johnson is the Jerome T. Murphy Research Professor of Education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education and is a former academic dean of the school. She was also co-chair of a collaboration between Harvard's education and business schools on the topic of public education. She directs the project on the next generation of teachers. I met up with Susan Moore-Johnson at this year's American Educational Research Association annual meeting, and I'll bring you my interview with her in two parts, this week and next week. In the first part of my interview, I asked Susan Moore-Johnson to tell me what the project on the next generation of teachers is for.
We started that project now 18 years ago, which is astonishing to me. The reason that we decided to focus in that way was that in the U.S. there was about to be a large turnover of highly experienced teachers who would be retiring, and it was not clear who was going to replace them for a variety of reasons: the labor market for teachers, the social expectations about careers across fields had changed substantially since the 1960s and 70s, when these retiring teachers were prepared and were entering teaching. So I started with that question. My daughter at that time, coincidentally, and perhaps not just totally coincidentally, was graduating from a liberal arts college, had no preparation in how to be a teacher, suddenly decided maybe that's what she really wanted to do. And so she joined Teach for America, which is an alternative preparation program in the U.S. And I was just very struck by talking with her and her counterparts in those programs about how differently they saw teaching and careers. And so that was, for me, a piece that focused what I wanted to do. I've studied the workplace of teachers for many years. What are the kinds of features that attract and support and retain teachers over time? So this was just a new take on that. So it was really a research program primarily that I ran with teams of doctoral students. And over time, we studied a variety of issues. Initially, it was all about new teachers coming in, but very quickly, it became a focus on the changes in the way schools were organized for teachers or policy affected teachers much more broadly.
And given that the project started 17 years ago and it has continued to date, is there still a need for that project, or have the needs changed over those 17 years?
There's definitely still a need to continue studying the issues about the intersection of teachers and policy and school organization in the U.S. In fact, I think one of our accomplishments has been to highlight the need to take quite seriously the context of teachers' work. There's been an increasing focus, I would say, since about 2000 on the individuals who become teachers. What's their preparation? You know, what were their test scores? What's their value add score in our new lingo? Much of it driven by, I think, quantitative researchers who were able to look closely at the career patterns of individuals, but not very closely at the interaction of the teacher and the work context. And so I think we've done a lot in both our research and the dissemination of that research, but also I'm not quite sure how many doctoral students I've had involved over this time, but it's not a small number. And a number of them now have the next generation of the next generation of research projects about this issue. So I think the issues have actually intensified in some ways. We kind of were able to see them coming, and they have been heightened really both by policy and by the realities of turnover in the teaching force.
And how was the context different for the teachers who entered teaching back in the 1960s compared to those that you were looking at entering the profession in the early 2000s?
I'll talk about my own experience very briefly because it was fairly typical. I graduated from a liberal arts college. My dad had been a teacher, so there was a lot of teacher modeling in my family. But when I was considering a career, there was no one recruiting me to go to law school or medical school, and certainly not investment banking or whatever.
Is that because you were a woman?
Yeah, yeah. And I was at a women's college, which was very committed to preparing, you know, women to take on leadership roles. But it was still a time when, for the most part, recruitment of very well-prepared undergraduates was for teaching and nursing. I was inclined to be a teacher anyway, but I realized that I never had this experience, which many people have today, of choosing from among a set of career options or thinking about teaching as a short-term career. I always, and this was true of the counterparts, and this is not just personal experience, but the research that we have, people were seeing their career long-term. Other careers were like that. You were a banker for your lifetime and you worked in the same bank that had the same name. You know, it was a continuity. We were never expected to highly coordinate our work with one another. It was the egg crate school for sure. And you did a good job with your students and you stayed there. So I left teaching, but I didn't leave education. And I know many, many people who entered in that time stayed with teaching until they retired. So part of it was this expectation of long-term commitment to kids. And if you were going to develop in your career, it was in your field, you know, you became better at teaching writing. Or if you were an elementary teacher, you might move from grade 3 to grade 5. But there were very few teacher leadership roles. Many of them, if they existed, were informal. And now the whole set of options is much greater, both inside and outside the profession.
So how then did you go about making teaching more attractive for those teachers in the early 2000s?
Well, I'm not sure we did. And I think one of the big issues is that the alternative preparation programs, Teach for America, Relay Education, there are a number of them, started to... This goes back to the focus on the individual teacher. So it was find the right individuals, lower the barriers to entry so it's not expensive and it doesn't take too much time, get those people right in the classroom and they'll know what to do. And so what happened was that there was a very different kind of teacher entering, different expectations. There was a way in which I always say the teachers who entered at that time kind of had their eye on the door from the beginning. I mean, there was not just the opportunity of exit, but unlike my generation, there were many options out there if you decided to leave. So I think it's been a challenge to recruit a longer-term candidate who sees education as a serious commitment, though not a lifelong commitment. I think we're not ever going to be back to that. With the development of more formalized teacher roles, I think there are people who can see themselves moving through a career, but there are only some people who really are both rewarded intellectually and socially for staying in the classroom for the long term, which is disappointing, but I think it's just the reality. I think now the question is, how do we make sure that however long individuals plan to be in teaching, they don't leave earlier because the context of their work is discouraging, essentially.
And why do you think that we're no longer looking on teaching now as a lifelong career? I mean, we wouldn't be saying that about dentists or about plumbers, electricians, anyone in other fields. Why is teaching different to those others?
I think in part it has to do with gender, that for so long it was perceived to be women's work, and that in part it was women's work because there weren't more options. So you're right, I don't know about the plumbers, but the dentists continue to be dentists. But many other parts of the society, there's this incredible fluidity of young people and jobs. And I used to think that if I were trying to hire someone and they'd had five jobs in their first 10 years out of college that I wouldn't even call that person in. But I've learned that this is perceived to be a sign of versatility and flexibility. You know, it's a different world. And teaching, I don't think, is much different than many other fields where people are moving around. The dentist, I would agree, stay put.
And has it to do with remuneration, for example, or has it to do with the conditions or the opportunities for promotion in the field?
I think a lot of it has to do with status, and that in the U.S. especially is very much tied to compensation. But the context of teachers' work, and we have not just in my project, but across a variety of projects, have documented quite clearly that if the school context doesn't provide a place for people to learn and grow and succeed, then either they change schools or they leave teaching. And I think they're leaving teaching at higher rates than they would have 15, 20 years ago. So much of it depends on the school leadership, and essentially that in most schools comes down to the principal and then some administrative staff. I've been studying teachers for 40 years now, and I always say I'm really interested in teachers, and I always end up saying, if you don't get the right principal, none of this will work. So school leadership is very important. I think at the same time that there was this focus on get the smartest people into teaching and they'll know what to do, schools began to hire non-education people to head up schools and school districts. And I think we've paid a real price for that. If the principal isn't perceived to be an instructional leader truly, as in could teach the things that, you know, he or she expects of teachers, can model the practice, then that puts real limits on the teacher's opportunities for growth and the school's success.
Has that practice stopped of appointing non-education people to leadership positions?
I would say it's slowed down some. I think because we have different regulations in the states about licensing for these different jobs, it varies quite a bit. But I think people have begun to either make very clear that they want principals who have had teaching success, not just experience and success, and also that if the principal is a superb manager but not particularly strong as an instructor, there's a recognition that there has to be an administrative team within a school, even a small team, where those particular areas of expertise are taken up by other people. Some places have formal roles for teacher leaders where that's really their responsibility. So it's gradual, though, and I don't think I could honestly give you a sense of how it's changing. I think people came up short and said, okay, this may not be working. We do not need to be organized like the U.S. military or a business or whatever. But that's still very attractive to some people who are the critics of public education.
One of the areas of particular concern for the project, the next generation of teachers, is the recruitment and retaining teachers in schools serving areas of poverty and disadvantage. Can you say a little bit about how the problem of recruitment and retention really affects those schools?
Yeah, I mean, the problem of recruitment is less obvious than the retention challenge, in that many people want to teach in high poverty schools. And the difficulty is that often those schools are headed by principals who have the least experience. And the schools can be places that are very inhospitable workplaces for teachers. So you see rapid turnover among new teachers as they move out of high poverty schools that are ineffective to often, you know, somewhat less poverty but more effective schools. The thing that's really important is that in these schools, serving high poverty, high minority student populations, there are some schools that are very successful, and they do not lack for candidates, and they do not lose their teachers. And it's really just a whole organizational approach to a school's commitment to all its students, which then leads to a much more systematic approach to supporting teachers. We've just finished a study of six schools, elementary and middle schools, within one city's limits. But some of these schools are state-sponsored charter schools. A couple of them are. A couple of them are what we call turnaround schools, where the state has moved in because of failure in the schools and reappointment of the principal and reappointment of at least 50% of the teachers. One of them of the six is a totally traditional school that's never had any special intervention or treatment. And what distinguishes them as a group is that they all, in the year that we studied them, were at the highest level of the rating system by the state. And it was the state of Massachusetts, which has a very strong and respected way of identifying schools that are failing or succeeding. So we wanted to know what's happening to the teachers in those schools. And they vary tremendously in the curriculum and in their approach to students, but about the ways in which they supported teachers, there was a great deal of continuity or similarity across these schools. Teachers were hired with great care, lots of investment in the hiring process. Teachers were never hired without doing demonstration lessons, meeting with new colleagues. And they worked on teams. They had very clear, dedicated time to work with colleagues about particular issues. It was not just you have a common planning time and maybe you'll collaborate, but actually a school-wide plan about that. And teachers loved and were committed to their work on teams. Nobody said it was wasted time, and that was very sustaining for them. There also was a new evaluation policy from the state was in effect, and so partly we were trying to figure out how are these schools doing this. Well, they were observing and providing feedback to a very high proportion of the teachers in the school very often. And it meant that by the time they got to March, which is when our final evaluations are finished, the teachers, that was all a continuous process for them. They had gotten so much feedback, been so much involved in conversations about how they were doing that it was just seamless in a way. And so it became much more about the formative process of evaluation of the observation and feedback. It was remarkable the intensity and the commitment of these schools to giving that kind of support to teachers. What several of them did, just back to an earlier point, is they used what extra resources they could gather, and they had different ways of getting them, to hire another administrator to do the operations work for the school. So the buildings and the maintenance and the attendance and the discipline, different individuals. And then the principals, where they were truly instructional experts, spent all their time in classes. So across these schools, I mean, it's not like these practices kind of popped up uninformed. They were in part copying what they had begun to learn from other schools. So these are all schools serving very high proportions of low-income students, succeeding, and the teachers are exhausted. I'm not sure that it is sustainable for some of them over time, but they still were very positive about what was happening in the school.
And one thing that strikes me there is that the schools have a certain amount of autonomy over their allocation of funds, which helps them make choices.
Right. And it was both the autonomy about spending and budgeting funds, but in some cases about being able to get additional resources. So the charter schools could raise foundation money. The turnaround schools had some federal grant money. So there was some money. The one traditional school that we studied that had none of that, they were operating under many of the same principles, but it was much harder for them to accomplish. They had only one administrator in the school. So although they were able to hand off some responsibilities to teacher leaders, they didn't have the funding to make those roles formal and permanent. We have so many schools and school districts that are providing these autonomies. Big districts that have essentially said, schools are autonomous with support and guidance and a lot of freedom. So I think we need to help people understand what's possible with that autonomy so that they're supporting teachers, stabilizing their teaching force, and providing the the systems that allow them to do that work.
Another aspect of the work that you did in the next generation of teachers related to the peer assistance and review programs. Can you say about a little bit about how that worked?
Well, this is an amazing program that actually was the brainchild of the president of the Teachers Union in Toledo, Ohio, and this was in the early 80s. So it has had a long history. It has been spawned as a result of something called the Teacher Union Reform Network, TURN. And many districts have adopted it, and it's been very successful, but it's kind of controversial on both sides of labor and management, so it still hasn't really taken hold as much as I would think. The idea is that expert teachers are appointed to assume responsibility for the induction, the mentoring of first-year teachers, and also for the evaluation of those teachers. Formal evaluation, so that the principal may have a little piece of that, but it's really these what we call consulting teachers who do that. And they also have a caseload of veteran teachers who have been identified as needing help and struggling and potentially being dismissed. And the intensity and special knowledge that those consulting teachers bring to that work is just extraordinary. And we studied seven districts closely, really to try to understand how they do it, how it works. It was really meant less to be a documentation of the effectiveness than a really detailed description of how it functions. Because it's controversial on the union side, because there are many teachers who, more experienced teachers especially, who don't think teachers should evaluate each other. Management side, the idea that you would turn over evaluation to teachers is, you know, just makes no sense at all. So it's controversial in that way, but in places that have adopted it, I mean, it's been very clear that the number of dismissals increases and the retention rate increases. So essentially what you're doing is making good judgments early and supporting people, and out of that comes some people who stay longer and are more effective. So it's quite good. Montgomery County, Maryland, which is one of the largest county districts in the U.S., a very diverse school district, has been committed to the professional career issue over the long term, and they have one of the most well-established and, you know, well-supported programs. The program is always run jointly by a panel of teachers, not part of the consultants, but teachers and management people. And the panel appoints the consulting teachers after a very thorough process of surprise visits to classrooms, and they look through a lot of information before they hire people.
In order to become a reviewing teacher.
That's right. And then they support them. So they work one-to-one with them in advising them, sometimes sitting in on their meetings with teachers. When the program is really worked out well, it's just fabulous. Sometimes places say they're going to do it and then just don't follow through with the funding or the roles or whatever. But it's quite impressive.
And are there, say, safety checks in the system? Like, for example, that supposing one teacher had a grudge against another teacher, that they wouldn't give them a negative review on that basis.
Right. They're quite careful about that. There are lots of opportunities. Because it's co-sponsored by the union, they have typically someone who's paying close attention to what's happening. Lots of room for people to object. But it's rare that that happens, because the selection of the consulting teachers is so good, you know, that it pays off.
And also another aspect of the next generation of teachers is what you call using data to drive instruction.
Mm-hmm.
Could you give a little bit of an idea about what's involved
there?
Well,
it's interesting, because this is a small part of a huge tidal wave, so to say, of responding to the fact that because of all of our extensive testing, there's an incredible amount of data that can be used to look at student progress, and in some cases to assess teachers on the basis of their student success. Our interest in it is less. I'm actually quite interested in all the reasons that using value-add statistical approaches to assessing what every teacher contributes to her students, I think that there are serious problems with that. But within schools, connected to the teamwork of teachers, is this opportunity for either a group of teachers who teach the same subject or teachers who teach the same students, so that would be the seventh grade teachers of different subjects, to review in a systematic way how their students are doing. So the data really are far more than the state test data. They are about the attendance records, about the disciplinary issues, about the family concerns, about the particular interests of students. Teachers have different ways of assessing within their own classes how much students are getting a particular topic. So for example, if a team of fourth grade teachers is reviewing a math curriculum that they're all teaching at the same time, they may have what our teachers now call exit tickets at the end of a class to gauge what students understand or don't understand. That's less about saying how is a particular student doing than how are we doing as instructors. And so the data analysis and monitoring means many things many places, but teachers are increasingly ready to look at data, look at interim assessments, try to figure out what students need. The hazard, of course, is that when there are very high stakes assessments for students, which there have been certainly up until now through No Child Left Behind, that then people start to teach the test. So there are problematic sides of this, but when teachers actually have data, they all look at it together, and they're assessing their own instruction and the students' well-being, it actually can be very productive, especially in high poverty schools where there's a lot of movement in and out of a school as a families move. Someone needs to be paying attention at the school level to what's happening to the students, to who's coming in, how they're being supported while they're there, you know, and how they're performing over time.
And that use of student data by teachers is part of the Next Generation of Teachers project, as described for me by Susan Moore Johnson of Harvard University. I'll bring you the remaining part of my interview with Susan on next week's programme. Well, that brings this week's Inside Education to a close. You can listen to podcasts of previous Inside Education programmes on InsideEd.com or on iTunes. You can email me with comments and suggestions to InsideEducation@DublinCityFM.ie. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.